Well, we went from unseasonably cold to unseasonably hot within a very short time frame. And we're going to find out what exactly happened from the weather guys. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. Back with us are Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. Hey, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. And John Martin, Professor and former Chair of Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. What are your weather-related questions or observations? Please join in the conversation. Our number, 800-642-1234, or send us an email at wpr.org. Well, gentlemen, it's so good to see you. You're in the studio with
us. It's unbelievable, Jill. It seems like a new world again.
It does. It's just like, it's wonderful.
Well, let's hope it lasts. Fingers crossed. So
I think it's going to last.
Yeah. So a few weeks ago, I had to turn my air conditioner on. So what exactly happened with that 90-degree humid weather? What was going on?
I want to put it in context before we try and answer why. All right. That was the 11th and 12th, I think, of May, right? I think it was.
Something like that. That whole week.
And we had the warmest overnight low in the month of May since 1874.
Whoa.
That week. It was 73 on that Wednesday morning. And that's exceptional. I think the all-time high for the month of May is 75. And that every other competitor, and they were all in the 1870s, by the way, every other competitor occurred in the last 7 days of the month of May. So we were 2 full weeks plus ahead of anything that had ever happened here in the recorded history of Madison. Doesn't mean it's never happened before, but it hasn't happened in 155 years.
Amazing.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
So why did... Oh, go ahead.
And the one other thing is, we were talking about this, there was no leaf out at the time.
No.
And so what happens when the leaves come out on trees is a lot more opportunity for the plants to actually contribute to the high water vapor content of the air by transpirating through their leaves. When there's no leaves, they're not doing that. So this was entirely a result of bringing water vapor from the Gulf of Mexico straight northward to the Great Lakes 2 or 3 or 4 weeks earlier than normal, to the degree that it was. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, definitely.
And that followed a really cool April well, which was also kind of, to get hit then by that warm weather, 90-degree weather, 4 days?
It was four straight days with 90 or higher for a high temperature.
The last time we had 4 days was the end of May.
Yeah, that's right.
So nothing this early.
Yeah, never happened before. In fact, well, only the one other time, as you point out, and that was May 26th to the 29th of 2018. So they're all recent vintage and incredible.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of our colleagues in the department has a fairly large collection of fruit trees on his property. And he said this is about the best spring he could have hoped for. Because it was, even though it was cold in April, it was never bitterly cold. So there was never any damaging frost. But it certainly kept the plants in their homes, you know, for a while, and said, we're not going to go out into this 35, 45 degree weather. And then when it got to be 90, everything exploded. And now there's no risk of a frost.
No.
Well, there was a little bit last night.
Yeah, in the northern part of the state.
But almost none. And so he figures that could be a really bountiful crop.
Oh, well, let's keep our fingers crossed. Yeah. I think it was good for the syrup producers, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think they had a long time period to be pulling maple syrup.
Yep, for sure.
And my tulips, too. I mean, my tulips, I saw a Facebook post of 5 years ago when they were all in bloom. And they were just, you know, creeping up at the end of April. It was, and now, wham.
Then they exploded.
Then they exploded really quick.
I want to see if ours have the same length of season, because I wonder if they just go crazy when they have this long delay and then the big burst out like that. I don't know.
Well, I know mine, the early ones burst out in that week, and then they went away really fast.
Yeah.
But then when the cold weather, cooler weather now, the later ones are up, and they're just slowly opening up. So maybe we'll get a variety. I don't know. We'll have to see. But and we're getting warmer again this weekend, back in the 80s. Is that normal, or are we off a little bit yet?
That's about climatologically.
Okay.
I think the climatological average around Memorial Day weekend is probably more like 75, but that's because it's a mix of cloudy or sunny Memorial Day weekends. If it's sunny, mid-80s is nothing unusual.
Uh-huh.
If it's cloudy, mid-70s or low-70s is about what you get. So they average out.
Okay, because I'm usually in the UP on Memorial Day, and it's never that warm.
Yeah.
It's not as much chillier up there.
Too much water. Big body
too much
of water.
Water. Cold water, too.
Cold water. Very cold
hot
water.
It gets warm even in August.
Well, it does these days, because that's changing, too, just like everybody else. You know, it's getting a little bit warmer. So we got a call from Susie in Eau Claire. A little off topic, but she has something to tell us. Hi, Susie.
Okay. First of all, I wanted to ask, how many years has this program been on WPR?
Which program you're talking about, Larry's or the Weather Guys? Oh, how long have you been here, guys?
Since 1998.
Wow.
Was the first show.
So 24 years?
Hard to believe.
Okay. The reason why I'm asking.
You guys look so young. You must have started when
and
you were
10. Feel so young.
Yeah. Doesn't he? I mean, he really does, doesn't he? He looks like he's in his late 20s.
Absolutely.
Sorry to insult you.
Go ahead, Susie.
I can see that. Okay. So my mother was an educator, and bit by bit, I find pieces of paper that she wrote things on. And I have a letter addressed to the Weather Guys. And my mother died 17 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So this is probably 20 years ago she wrote you this letter.
Oh,
and now here you are.
So here
are the questions.
Okay. Huh? You have her questions?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And you know, since technology has changed so much, I'm sure that you can answer these, or maybe 20 years ago you couldn't. Okay, so I'm just going to give you all the questions because they all pertain to the same thing. I'm going to say that bad four-letter word, snow. So why is snow quiet and rain is not quiet? How much does a snowflake weigh compared to a raindrop? How much more moisture is there in a raindrop than in a snowflake? And how many snowflakes does it take to make a raindrop? And the last question is, can you turn a raindrop into real snow? Which I think you can. So I'm going to take it off the air and listen to you on the radio.
Oh, thank you, Susie. Oh, my gosh. That's lot of interesting questions. Go ahead, Steve.
Those are great questions.
Yeah.
Snow is a lot more fluffier and therefore quiet. And so when it hits the ground, I mean, it floats. I would classify snowflakes floating. And raindrops is falling.
Okay.
And so, and they splash, right? Whereas when a snowflake lands on the ground, it just sits there.
Mm-hmm.
And then once the snow gets on the ground, there's a lot of air gaps in between the two. And so it acts like a soundboard as well. And so that helps to keep it quiet as well. A lot of snow often starts or can start off as a tiny liquid drop that then freezes and grows into a snowflake. So you could have that mixture. And rain sometimes is snow at one point that does melt before it hits the ground.
Mm-hmm. So can you turn, did she ask if you can turn rain into snow? Is that what she had mentioned at the end there?
Yeah, and you know, raindrops, as they first form, they may be a liquid particle.
Mm-hmm.
And then as it begins to grow, then it can freeze and turn into a snowflake,
mm-hmm.
For sure.
Yeah.
And of course, snowflake will melt. There'll be ice and clouds, thunderstorms, even in the summertime, up high. And that'll melt on its way down.
On its way down.
And turn,
oh, that makes
turn
sense.
Into rain.
Well, I didn't think we'd be talking about snow today, but if anybody has a question, our lines are free.
Snow, you can't go wrong.
Always a good day to talk about snow.
No, you guys. 800-642-1234. Give us a call. So there's been a lot of severe weather going on, including a dust storm in South Dakota. I saw the picture. Oh my gosh, it was scary. How do those form and why was it so large?
So that particular dust storm was, you know, a lot of times even around here, when you get a thunderstorm, you get that gust front, that really strong air that hits you. And that's what that dust storm was from up in the South Dakota that even went into Iowa and Nebraska. So it was associated with a storm, not a lot of vegetation around. The wind gusts were up to 107 miles per hour.
Oh, my gosh.
So you can imagine that it's just going to kick the soil up and the lighter particles, it'll just pick it up into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And the photos that I saw of that look like dust storms that you saw in the 1930s.
I was thinking that same thing.
Really, really big.
Mm-hmm.
Same exact mechanisms. And, you know, it's a matter of if you have a region that hasn't been recently wetted by precipitation, it's not going to be too difficult to have dust available. And then if you got to get, all you got to do is get the winds.
Right, yeah. And 107 mile per hour gust front.
That'll do it.
How unusual is that?
I don't know off the top of my head. I think that dust storms in the plain states and in the prairie provinces of Canada are probably not that uncommon. They're just to get them in succession or to get a series of them in a given season is uncommon. So the one-off event is probably not so unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been pretty dry all the whole western
That's
half
right.
of the U.S.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
in terms of lack of precipitation. So
yeah, and
dust storms or fires. What are you going with?
That's right. And that's along those lines. You know, those are some of the leading characteristics of changes due to the global warming that's going on. Is mm-hmm. drier conditions in the western half of the U.S. So they may become more common
right.
than they have been.
Yeah. We have Jacob in Green Bay who has a question for us. Go ahead, Jacob.
Hey, so I had the radio off while I was calling, so you may have, I heard you were talking about climate change. The last couple of years, it seems like across the U.S., there's been some long, cold winters later in the season where we get a ton of snow, maybe less snow in like December, January, and then getting dumped on in the later seasons. And then immediately transitioning to hot weather. I was wondering, is this a result of climate change or is this just coincidental?
That's a good question.
I don't know what it was.
Oh, so
yeah, unfortunately,
John, we lost John who's our snow expert.
You can't hear that, yeah.
but you know, Jacob was pointing out how the recent winters, and you might remember this better than me, were generally dry. And then there's snowstorms coming later
longer winters
yeah,
and
so
shorter
longer
springs.
Winter that way. And, you know, I think we sort of saw that this year. So I may be biasing my remembrance on that, where in January we really didn't have. And in December, we didn't really have very many snowstorms.
No,
not
we had
down
a,
here. Not
yeah,
down
not
here.
Down
up
here.
North they
yeah,
did.
Up north they did. Here in Madison, we had, I think, our snowiest month was 9.1 inches, and that was January, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we made a run in April. We got up to
That's
five.
Right.
We
yeah.
made a run that April could have been the snowiest month of the winter. I mean, if it had gotten one more event, and in places close to us did. So I don't know if there's a trend yet in terms of much of the snow or some larger fraction of the snow coming in the late part of the season or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that is certainly an interesting question.
Definitely is. And I noticed that myself. I think I got my snowblower out one time this year. Not that I'm complaining. Mm-hmm. So.
I'm not complaining about that either.
Okay, you guys can have your fun. Next year is my year.
Next year's your year. We're talking with John Martin. He's a professor and former chair of the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And Steve Ackerman, he's vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. He's also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Do you have weather questions or observations? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll be back right after this look at the news. That music means the weather guys are back with us today. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have John Martin, a professor and former chair of the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and Steve Ackerman, vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. Do you have questions for them? Well, write this number down because our lines are all filled, but it's 800-642-1234, and you can always send an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. So guys, let's just go straight to the phone since we have so many people wanting to ask you questions. First up is Eric in Kenosha. Hi, Eric. What's your question?
Hi. I have two questions, both based on the original unusual weather that was discussed at the beginning of the program. First, what does that weather mean, if you can opine on it? For the intensity of flies out on Lake Michigan during this coming summer? And my second question is, again, based on that weather pattern discussed, what does that weather pattern mean for the intensity of thunderstorms, particularly squall lines, moving out across Lake Michigan from Wisconsin over the course of the summer? Thank you.
Yeah, so let's take the flies first. What I noticed, and this is just an observation, I would think that with the cooler weather, it might have changed when the flies would hatch. But I'm certain as we move into summer and things warm up, that we'll probably see more conditions relevant to that current weather. But mm-hmm. We had noticed around our house in early May a bunch of gnats and flies flying around. So I don't know if there was a delay in the hatching because of the cool April weather. And then the same thing with the thunderstorms. You know, it was, April was really cool. And then, you know, May hit and it's, you know, we had those really hot days. And so I think as we look towards the thunderstorms in the summertime, again, it'll be more local, it'll be more driven by what are the conditions in later May and June than what kind of set us up.
Yeah.
Now, what it might impact, though, is because April was so cool, the lake temperatures may stay cooler than what they normally would have, particularly since April was really cloudy, so you didn't have a lot of that solar energy warming up the water. So mm-hmm. that might increase the gradients between the water temperatures and the air, which then might lead to sea breezes, which could actually enhance convection as it collides with the warmer, moist air.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. Thanks, Eric. So we're having little problems with headphones, and John can't hear. So, Steve, how about we try this? You take your headphones off, turn them up a little bit, and see if you both can hear, okay? Oh, I'm sorry to do this on the air, but it's the only way I can think of to do it. So he can answer questions, too. And we did get an email from Bonnie. Bonnie says her daughter is pursuing a degree in meteorology. Could the weather guys give a sampling of the meteorology or atmospheric research being done at UW. Wow, that's a big topic.
Yeah, it's wide open. I mean, we do, in our department, we have people exploring almost every facet of our very broad science. So we've got people who are exploring the small-scale processes within clouds that lead to precipitation development of all kinds, snow, rain, hail, all of it, all the way up to the largest scales of the climate system and how the Earth circulation of atmosphere and ocean work together. And in between, we've got people who are studying, well, maybe broadly, people who are studying how to observe the atmosphere and ocean, both with what you'd call conventional observations and, of course, Steve's expertise, remote sensing observations with satellites, which has been a revolution. And the reason why forecasts out to 5 or 6 days are better now than they were 20 years ago is precisely because of that. And then we've got people working on the nature of winter storms, the nature of summertime convective storms, the nature of the climate system and circulations in the tropics and how they interact with the extratropics. There's almost nothing that you can't do in our department in terms of what you know, interest that comes from our science. Yes. So it's as broad as possible.
So exciting. I mean, this must be exciting for you guys who've been in the business for a little while. The advancements that you must have seen just in the last 20 years.
Oh, yeah, it's incredible.
Crazy.
I mean, I think about what I just said to you a minute ago, Jill, that the notion that a 5-day or a 6-day forecast is something that you really ought to put stock in.
Yeah.
Every time, even though occasionally, of course, they're going to be wrong, but you should never blow it off, because the technology and the science underlying the use of that technology has progressed to such an extent that we're living in an age that no other human beings have ever lived in. I mean, when you think about it, nobody until the last 50 years could even depend on a 2-day forecast. And now we're talking about 6, 7, and 8, and there's people who are making progress into things that are sub-seasonal. So it's remarkable.
Yeah.
And when we started, we were looking at, you know, the 1 to 2 day forecast.
That's right.
And now
that's right.
It's right. Going out 5 days is not that hard for us.
Exactly right.
You still want to be checking it. You can't. It's not 100% accurate, but you get a good sense when you look out 5 days from now. Which,
yep.
When we started this, you would have to do 2 days out, 1 day.
Exactly. And as I've always said, I mean, the test to me, the acid test, is does the forecast paint the complexion of whatever the day is in the future that you're looking towards? Mm-hmm. And I would say more than 90% of the time, it does, mm-hmm. without regard for season. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be that it was better in the winter than it was in the summer. It's not even true anymore. Mm-hmm. So
it's amazing. Yeah. Well, thanks for that email, Bonnie. Let's go back to the phone. We've got Keith in Forest County. Hi, Keith. What's your question?
Good afternoon. And thanks. Delightful to talk with you. Every year for the past 20 years, I drive from my home in Washington State to Wisconsin in the middle of May. And it's been a pretty easy drive, except this year when the winds in all of those states in the northern tier of states in the country were just amazing. Every day I would deal with winds of 25 to 30 miles an hour with gusts into the 40s and 50s continually. Can you talk a little bit about the atmospheric conditions that seem to have caused these unusually high, consistent winds? And thank you.
Okay, thanks, Keith. Appreciate that. So that kind of goes with our dust storm, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, two things. One is the whole West seems to be relatively dry right now.
Yeah.
And then some strong winds. And these winds for the dust storm that we saw in South Dakota were associated with a thunderstorm still, or I don't know how much it actually rained, but the gust front associated with that really kicked up the dust.
Mm. And then the other thing was beginning of our conversation this morning was how warm it was May 10th through 12th or 13th. And that was a function of a much larger scale circulation anomaly, which was a deep trough sitting over the southwest of the United States. And that was what fluxed all the water vapor poleward towards us and made us so incredibly humid for the time of year. But the other consequence was a succession of storms over the Intermountain West. And if you're driving from, you know, Washington State to Wisconsin,
it's a long drive.
It's a long drive. You're going to run into, if you're experiencing a somewhat abnormally active storminess in that region, that's going to be a factor. Plus, the terrain makes a big difference for the winds. You don't need really large pressure contrasts in the presence of a lot of high relief terrain to have really strong winds. And it can be quite local too. You can be on the highway and in one little gap, you suddenly are in 90 mile per hour wind. So, and that'll make an imprint on your memory of your trip across the country for that year. So it's a whole combination of things like that. They're not unrelated. They're all, in fact, strongly connected.
Okay.
Looks like.
Well, great. Thanks for that call then question, Keith.
Thank you.
Let's go next to Larry in Prairie du Chien. It's not our Larry, but hi, Larry. What question do you have for us?
Hi. Well, I have a question and a comment. My question is, the term snow showers, that seems to be a more recent term. I don't remember that, years back. And my comment is, talking about the changing climate, none of my daffodils bloomed this year, because of the crazy cool weather, I think, and then that real hot weather. It's just a little observation on how the climate can affect things. Thank you.
You know, I'll make a comment on the daffodils because we have a bunch of different daffodils and hundreds of tulips. And most of my daffodils did bloom except for one breed. The plant came up and everything. And this was a breed that had almost like multiple heads, a very intense.
Fancy, right?
Yeah, really fancy one. And so I don't know. I wonder if that was the case that just kept that from blooming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really interesting.
It could be because the hybrids tend to be sometimes a little bit more picky than
the others.
And
this was definitely a hybrid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they got strategies. They want to try to survive. So if nature is throwing them a lot of curveballs, they're going to get out of the batter's box that season, it seems to me, and just wait for the next time, take an at-bat. But on the snow showers thing, I think that's an interesting comment. I think it depends on where you live in the country. And because the frequency and type of snowfall events that one might experience in those different locations can lead to a larger vocabulary. It really makes sense for us in Wisconsin to talk about snow showers as opposed to steady snow. Whereas if you live in Alabama, every time it snows, it's probably just a snow shower. You're not going to really get an accumulation. So you can imagine there might be regional differences in the language. I like that word, even though I'll agree with, I think, the sentiment expressed by the caller that it seems a little bit wimpy in a place where snow can really get you down to have something called a snow shower. It almost sounds like something to celebrate. For me, of course, it is. For others, it's not. But it does delineate between steady, watch out snow and the kind that it's just going to be 5 minutes long and might coat the grass with white in
flurries,
November.
Basically.
Flurries.
Yeah.
But it's even more than that because flurries are the intermittent snow that you might get all day long that never accumulates. And a snow shower is a little bit more intense flurry activity that lasts for 50 minutes.
So on a scale, there's flurry, then there's snow shower.
So as I say, I think.
And then there's a snow dump.
Depending on where you live, you know what those words mean in relation to each other. In another parts of the country, you'd have no idea why there's so many. I think that's true.
Yeah. That's true.
But we also have rain showers too.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's sort of the same thing.
It's just very intermittent
and intense, and
that's
then
right.
It goes away.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we did get an email from Jim in Cedarburg, and he said that last time you guys were asked if it's windier than it used to be, you said it was no. So how do you determine averaging winds given anecdotal evidence to the contrary? And do wildfires out west contribute to the weather here, and how does it manifest?
So two things.
Yes.
First is that We did look at the mean winds, and we did an article on that for the local paper here. And what we saw is that the average wind has been decreasing. Mm. The monthly average wind has been decreasing in Madison, for sure. Mm-hmm. And that's been going on now for, I don't know, 50, 70 years or something.
Yeah, some longer period of time.
It was. And I think the other thing that we came to a conclusion was that the other thing is we tend to, I think, remember those days that are either really calm, but more importantly, I think we also really remember those that get wind gusts of high speed. And we didn't have the data to look at what the wind gusts were climatologically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you take the sort of, I think it's a five-minute average, is it? When you get the wind speed is a five-minute average, and so that's not going to account for every gust. And Steve's right, exactly right. He did the analysis. The analysis is clear as day. And when one's confronted with numerical averages of observed data versus anecdotes, I always go with the observed averages, even though they very often can seem to completely contradict your own recollection. So I'm in complete cahoots with the caller on that. But you got to side with the numbers. They don't lie.
And I think we remember those extreme events.
Yeah,
that's why.
Remember those really windy things. So it's not.
You get an imprint on your memory that's hard to dislodge.
Yeah.
So as far as the wind, this probably sounds really stupid to you guys as scientists, but if we've been building so much, Madison's gotten bigger and bigger, would that cut down on the wind?
It does. But where the official measurements are made, there's requirements that it be flat, not buildings around
unobstructed.
Airports. That's why most are made in airports.
That totally makes sense. Yeah. Okay. All right. Sounds good. Let's take another call. We've got Tyrone in Milwaukee. Hi, Tyrone. How are you?
Well, good afternoon. Thank you. Am I coming through?
You certainly are. What's your question?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jill. Good afternoon, guys, and good afternoon to all the listeners. Well, a couple of different things. Well, I know in the Midwest here, and pretty much the Midwest and the East, we're pretty much affected by the jet stream for a lot of the wind that we get out of Canada and off our lakes. But the question that I had to pose to the guys were that as far as elements in the air and things that we're breathing and even some of the, you know, because I'm ready for some 70, 80 degree weather right now. And, you know, because I'm a July baby, so I'm ready for the heat, man. But anyway, what does the formulas, the winter gasoline formula and the summer gasoline formulas, as best you can, how are those affecting us? I mean, you know, whatever those derivatives are that they put in both the winter formula and then they reduce it down to the summer formula. Nobody really does much talking about that, but I believe that's got a lot to do with, you know, how we're, you know, all the different, you know, pathogens, I should say, and different things that are in the air. So as best you can, maybe tackle that and see what you can come up with that then. And thank you very much then. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, there's what the blend is actually mandated by local conditions and the regulations in that state, and then sometimes they're overridden by federal regulations, and they all revolve around air quality. So whatever's coming out of the tailpipe, whatever's coming out of and its ability to be mixed out of the region by winds, not only horizontally but up and down, to ventilate the air is really a critical aspect. Places like Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Basin, is surrounded by mountains on three sides, and they have what is called an inversion, sits on top of the boundary layer, the lowest part of the atmosphere that touches the ground. And so they have really strong restrictions on a variety of different things. The whole blend of gasoline has to be different in the LA Basin for health reasons. So these are not just decisions made without any particular reason. They're made to protect people's health. Same is true in Houston, where it gets really hot in the summertime and muggy. That's a good place to grow ozone in the lower part of the atmosphere, which it doesn't usually sit there, and that's really toxic for your lungs. So they have some really high standards for to try and reduce the ozone concentration, and it's all made by the exhaust from tailpipes in a place like Houston. So there's a lot of background chemistry science and atmospheric science that goes into some of those decisions, and that's about as much as I know about it. We live in a place here where the air is easily and quite regularly ventilated throughout the year. We don't have any of those local problems like they might in Salt Lake City or in LA or in Houston. I don't know. You probably know more than I do.
No, I think I agree with you 100%. And I was wondering, as you were making those comments, is that we don't really change anything in Wisconsin, even though it gets really humid in the summertime.
Yeah,
But even so, because we're so open, we get winds, it kind of pushes the air out, unlike basins like LA or Utah. Yeah. The air gets trapped down there, and then it just chemically changes, and it becomes not too healthy for you.
Yeah, right. It can be really bad.
Yuck. Yeah. Okay, thanks for that call, Tyrone. We'll go to Claire in Sauk County. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Jill. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask the weather guys, are we still in a drought? How long has it lasted? And what's the long-term outlook for the rest of the year in Wisconsin?
Great question. Yeah.
We are in a, I think now, not any longer even a moderate drought. We had some relief in the southern part of the state anyway. Maybe the whole state, actually.
In the north,
too, okay. Mm-hmm. The north had a good amount of snow. We mentioned that earlier this winter. But I think we were in a drought for an extended period of time. It was never more than moderate, I don't think, in many locations. There might have been a few places where it was severe.
But not right. Most of it was moderate.
We're out of that now. Places in the west, our wide areas in the west, are experiencing severe drought, and that's been prolonged. So that's a really scary effect. But in the state of Wisconsin, we're kind of out of that now. And the outlook for the summer is about 50-50 in terms of regular or not precipitation. I think it's supposed to be a little warmer than normal, but I don't think I've heard that it's going to be wetter than normal. So it's about average is the expectation.
That's what I saw, too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad I got that new air conditioner then.
Oh, you will be, yeah.
Let's go to Tim in Madison. Hi, Tim. Tim, are you there? Not hearing Tim. Okay, let's put him back on hold, and let's go to Jerry in the Wisconsin Dells.
Good afternoon, folks. Thanks for taking my call to the weather guys. Love this show and love your columns in the State Journal every week. Really appreciate it as a fellow weather geek. I'm calling about cloud-to-cloud and cloud-to-ground lightning. These storms that moved through north of the Dells last week that dumped inches of rain had almost no cloud-to-ground lightning and a really copious amount of cloud-to-cloud lightning. Other much smaller storms produce impressive cloud-to-ground and almost no cloud-to-cloud lightning. If it's well understood, what's the dynamics that's causing this?
Good question.
I don't know. It's a really good question.
I have some speculations for the background. I think it's entirely, this is amazing, but I think it's true. It's entirely controlled by the microphysics in the clouds. Yeah. So how big are the pieces of ice? How plentiful are they? How do they move around? And the dynamical part might be how strong is the updraft. But that often differentiates between strong downpours and weak ones, but not always. So I don't know about the lightning, but I've noticed the same thing, not in this recent event, but in my years here, almost 30 years living here, there are some times where you get really heavy gully washer type rain and you don't see any cloud to ground lightning. And then other days where it's all cloud to ground. So it's very interesting, but I have a feeling it's controlled by the microphysics in the cloud.
Yeah, and you know, a couple of years, maybe 2-3 years ago, we put a new lightning detector on satellites, on the geostationary satellite.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if anybody's looked at that yet, trying to correlate, because now you can see ones that aren't hitting the ground from the satellites. And so I wonder if anybody's done that study yet to look at. I mean, we won't be able to look at any long-term changes, but... to what degree is it related to different types of precipitation?
Yeah, really interesting. Yeah. And who would guess, you know, one of the most awesome phenomena that you can experience from the weather, you know, locally, lightning, is controlled by microscopic particles. And their population and their characteristics. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we're just about ready to wrap things up here, but official hurricane season starts June 1st.
Oh, yes.
What are they predicting? Have you guys seen any
I don't know if I've seen. I thought it was maybe a normal season or something, but there's a La Nina going on.
There's a La Nina going on.
And that makes it a little bit more likely you get a few more storms.
I think that's way worse for La Nina.
Yeah, I think I read that they think it's probably going to be a little higher too. Who are they? Who does these predictions?
In that case, it would be the National Hurricane Center.
Okay.
The precipitation prediction for the U.S.
And another of the whole high profile early season indications, and then they updated too, comes from Colorado State.
Right.
Is it Phil? Can't remember his last name off the top of my head.
I'm thinking of Bill Gray.
Yeah, he used to work with Bill Gray. Yeah. Phil is his protege and works, and they make a statistical forecast on that. So.
And then, of course, the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellites has a really big hurricane.
Okay. Well, I got to cut you off, guys. I know you keep talking for another hour, but we've been talking with Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. He's also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And John Martin is a professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Studies in UW-Madison. Tomorrow is Vet Day. We have a large animal vet coming in, so please tune in for that. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay well.